Please remember that you do have an outline in your packet of materials. It will help you to follow my line of thought and give you an opportunity to visually see what we're doing as you jot it down, as well as providing for you some notes that you could take home and continue your study. So this is my second lecture. It is on the historical function of the creation account. It's a very important issue that we have before us in this particular hour. And so let me introduce what we're going to be doing. And first, in your outline, first, our specific purpose. I'm not going to give a full, thorough exposition of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. I wish we had time for that kind of study, but we do not have time for that. But what I want to do is lay the groundwork that is necessary for properly approaching, analyzing, and understanding the creation narrative in Genesis 1 and 2. So you're going to get the groundwork that you build on. After you have this groundwork, then you could build up your study of Genesis 1 and 2 by looking at it verse by verse throughout the text. Now, I do believe in six-day creation, as you well know from last night's lecture and from the very purpose of this particular conference. I believe in six-day creation because I believe the Bible demands it. I don't believe the Bible simply suggests it, or perhaps it was a six-day creation process. I believe the Bible is very clear. As I noted last night, the 10 exegetical reasons for interpreting the days of Genesis as 24-hour periods, those exegetical notations give us a powerful statement that God created the heavens and the earth in six sequential 24-hour days. So the Bible demands it. I'm not here to be a Bible thumper, just to show that I'm a fundamentalist or something like that. I'm not here to thumb my nose at the world, because the world is so enamored with evolution. Nor am I here as an evangelical who wants to rework the creation account, which many evangelicals do. They cleverly sidestep what Moses has presented to us in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. Rather, I am here to provide a careful introduction to how we are to understand the creation narrative as it was written. Now, my book out there, Jason Lyle has about 15 books out there. I've got one. And the title of it is, As It Was Written, The Genesis Account, Literal or Literary. And the point of this is to show what we're doing here in this conference, or what I'm doing in this conference, that we're to understand the Genesis narrative, the creation narrative, as a literal historical account of what actually transpired in creating history and creating the world in which we live. And so I want us to have this under evangelical reworkings, not according to a liberal overthrowing, but as it was originally written. Now, the problem that we face today, one of the problems we face today, is that many, too many, evangelical scholars have created innovative approaches to the creation narrative in Genesis 1. Vern Poitras, a very knowledgeable scholar at Westminster Theological Seminary, very competent scholar, has a book where he outlines 10 different views of the book of the creation narrative. It's called Christian Interpretations of Genesis 1. Now, when I read Genesis 1, I see one interpretation. But there have been evangelical scholars that are trying to avoid the implications of a six-day creation because it doesn't fit with the current narrative of the world. And so they have developed these other views, these innovative views. These evangelicals are seeking to avoid an embarrassment in our evolutionary-based culture. They don't want to embarrass the Christian faith or to embarrass Christian scholarship, so they're thinking, well, we can rework the account so that it fits with the evolutionary approach, but also defends the Scripture in their view. Evolution, as you well know, dominates our modern culture, and therefore these evangelicals have a heart to defend the Scriptures and to defend the Christian faith, but they are failing because they are not accepting Genesis 1 and 2 as it was written. But instead, they're trying to remake it in the image of evolution, basically. Another problem we have, and that this conference is hoping to minister to, is that many evangelical Christian, evangelical laymen who are not in the scholarly realm debating these issues at a real deep level, many evangelical Christians recognize that Genesis 1 teaches a six literal historical day creation process. They believe that God factually presents the material in Genesis chapter 1, but they're not well schooled in it. They're not ready to face the opposition from evangelicals who have reworked the account. And it's easy to get tripped up. Many evangelicals, when they are confronted with these alternative approaches to the book of Genesis, will kind of back down and just be quiet and not stir up any controversy because they are not well schooled in it. Your church's conference has been established to equip you so that you might be able to challenge the opposition, that you might be able to respond when the six-day narrative is challenged, and they are giving you the tools. This, your pastor and your elders are giving you the tools, or better, not just giving you tools, but giving you weapons for the warfare that you face in the modern fallen world. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10, 4 and 5, a very important passage for a Christian worldview. He says, "The weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we're taking captive every thought to the obedience of Christ." And that should be our calling, recognizing that we're in a war with unbelief and that we are to defeat the unbeliever intellectually, not by weapons that are carnal and of the flesh, but we're to defeat them. And in this creation narrative, we have the foundation to a Christian worldview, which we must defend and we must use in our promoting the Christian faith and the Christian worldview in our modern world. And so this message this morning that I'm presenting is going to deal with the historical function of the creation account. Why does the Bible open with the creation account? Now, I will be opening with the broad issue. It's going to be very broad, and then I'm going to be narrowing it as I go along step by step to bring it into focus. And we will see that the creation account was meant to be understood historically. The creation narrative deals with real history. It's not just beautiful poetry saying, yes, God is the creator of all, but it is dealing with and actually demands that we understand it in a historical way. The creation narrative deals with historical reality. And so I'm going to be building the case for the historical function of the creation account. Now be aware, some of it will be a little bit tedious, but it is quite important, and hopefully it'll soak in. I must build a case step by step, but I do hope at the end of this lecture you'll say, aha, I see what he was driving at. I see why that's important. Now I know the broad foundation upon which he has built this superstructure. And so it will go step by step, and I do hope you have an aha moment. So hang in there. There will be a payoff. And I'm not simply talking about lunch is your payoff. Though that is very biblical, Paul says, I buffet my body. So we always want to buffet our bodies and enjoy lunch. All right, secondly, did y'all get that joke? Didn't hear a hearty amen. Usually when you mention food, there's an amen from the audience. But secondly, another preparatory note, our fundamental question, a vitally important issue, is what type of literature is the book of Genesis itself? Now, basically, there are two broad categories. Now, there are distinctions that you could break these categories down into, but basically, there are two broad categories, or two broad categories of possibilities as to how we're to understand the book of Genesis. Genesis is either one or the other. And particularly the creation account we're interested in. It's either prose or narrative, or poetry. Prose or poetry. Poetry, if it were poetry, poetry can allow high symbolism and a great degree of freedom of expression. Poetry would emphasize the aesthetic impact of the creation narrative over against the exact information that we might be looking for. So if the creation narrative was poetic, we wouldn't know particularly what God did, but we would know in a beautiful and powerful way that God created all things. We would be left with that, but we would have liberty in trying to understand the various steps of the creation process. But if it's prose, if the creation narrative is prose, it encourages a more literal reading. It encourages more literal features because it will tie the story to historical reality. It will locate the creation account in the real world where you live. So which is Genesis? And more particularly, which is the creation narrative that we find in Genesis 1 and 2? Is it poetry that presents us an artistic declaration that God created all things? A beautiful, moving poem that says God created all things without getting into the details of how he did it? Or is the creation narrative prose literally declaring God created all things in this way? So poetry might say God created all things, but the historical narrative will say he created all things and in this way, after this manner. Now this message will show that Moses was concerned with history, real world history. Christians, the historical setting of the creation account is vitally important, and we should expect for this for several reasons. So let's see how first. Now we're going to remember, I'm beginning very broadly. Now Roman number one in your outline there, Israel's historical interest. Israel's historical interest. Now this point will be brief. The series will further elucidate what I'm getting at, but it is foundational to the other issues that we will be studying this morning and throughout the day. Now, my point is, Israel's worldview was rooted in history. Israel was not interested in philosophy. Israel was not tempted by mythology. Israel had a strong and deep interest in history, the real world history in which Israel found itself, in which we find ourselves. It is a very historical religion. Israel's creation view should match its historical interest. So what I'm saying is, Israel has a very strong historical interest. And as we approach the creation account, we should say, well, does Israel's historical interest impact the way we're to approach the creation account? And I believe that it does. We may see this point confirmed in the light of three issues. Now notice this, capital A, the implications of Israel's covenant. Israel was established as a covenant people, which I'm sure you're well aware. They began to be formed as a people through the calling of Abraham, beginning in Genesis 12 and following. God's covenant is tied to Israel's genealogy, her genealogical development, and to Israel's historical land. The covenant deals with her genealogy and her land. For instance, Genesis 15:18 says, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land. His descendants, to his genealogy, he's being given this particular historical land. And so the heart of the covenant requires historical descendants, real people in a real world, and it requires a receiving of a historical land, a piece of real estate over in the Middle East, or what we call the Middle East today. And so the covenant deals with the genealogical development of the people of God in history, in time, and on earth, and what their relationship is to a particular land in time and on earth. If you read the Old Testament, you will be very much aware of Israel's interest in genealogies. We find them spread throughout the Old Testament. And in fact, in the Genesis 5 and 10, we have two crucial early genealogies when we have tracing out the genealogy of Adam and then the genealogy of Noah. And so these are crucial to what he's doing there in Genesis, in the opening chapters of Genesis. And now we're going to study later that this will show the significance for Israel's world role, Israel's role in history. Therefore, Israel's view of creation should fit with her historical covenant. The covenant framed her in, founded her. The covenant was very historical, dealing with genealogy, descendants, and dealing with the land. So you would think that Israel's view of creation would fit her historical covenant. But secondly, capital B, the implications of Israel's books. Now, the bulk of Israel's writings are historical. Of course, we have the Psalms, which are poetic, and some other poetry here, there, and in various places. But the bulk of Israel's writings are historical. None is mythological. And I want to give samples of the historicity of Israel's books. And I'll focus on the first five books, though if we had time, we could go through so many others. In Genesis, we have the history recorded that gives us the history of the formation of the world, of the human race, the coming of sin to corrupt the human race, and the founding of Israel herself. And these are foundational to the Bible story. This world is where the Bible story unfolds. The fall of man is why the Bible story has a redemptive angle to it. Israel's mission is going to be crucial, and we'll be looking at that in just a minute. So we're dealing with real world issues in Genesis. Exodus is a history of Israel's leaving Egypt and going to Sinai, where she will become a historical nation, and she will have laws given to govern her in the historical realm. This is not mythology. This is history. Leviticus, the very next book of the Bible, the very next of the Moses' Pentateuch, as it's called, gives rules for the historical worship of God in an objective tabernacle. This shows step-by-step procedures how God is to be worshiped in the real world, in time, and on earth. It deals with history. In Numbers, we have the tracing of the wilderness wandering of Israel as she moves to the Promised Land. Because she tends to sin against God, she has to wander through the wilderness for 40 years instead of taking the trek across it in just a number of weeks. And in Numbers, we have many places named, many cities, many regions, many people. Historical names of historical places and historical people. It's dealing with history. Deuteronomy is a summation of Israel's history to the time of Moses' death. It gives Israel's history, and the law is reformulated again before she enters into the Promised Land. Well, on and on we could go through the Old Testament, following into Joshua, Judges, etc., showing that there is a strong historical interest. Israel is not involved in mythology. She is involved in history, and she knows it quite well. An evangelical linguist named Mark Kay has said, quote, "The Hebraic mindset was deeply and inextricably attached to the march of time." And that's important when we're reading the Jewish works of the Old Testament. They are tied to history inextricably. The Dictionary of Old Testament Historical Books, a major study guide for today, says, "Chronological sequence is the backbone of the Bible's narrative books." Chronological sequence, the backbone of the narrative books of the Old Testament. And we're going to be seeing that the Genesis account is a part of that backbone, the Genesis account of creation. Christians, Israel is interested in real history. Her holy books were rooted in it. Again, they were not mythological, they were historical. And her record of beginnings should match her historical interest. And so the fact that the creation account is there in this historical setting suggests to us that it also has a historical interest. Well, thirdly, number C, the implications of Israel's outlook. The ancient world believed in a cyclical view of history, that literally history was going nowhere. History was engaged and caught up in repetitive cycles that tended to recur and were repeated over and over again. But many scholars, not even necessarily evangelical ones, but many scholars note that Israel created a concept that we call today linear history. You have the cyclical view of history of ancient paganism, then you have Israel with her linear view of history. History advances step by step from the past into the present, off into the future. That's a linear conception of history. And all of this starts in Genesis and even in the creation account, because we have day one, day two, three, four, five, six, and seven. So we see this chronological development, this narrative development. Israel does not have a repetitive cyclical view of history. Rather, day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and then the progress of Adam's genealogy on to Noah's and on through the Old Testament. And Bible prophecy develops Israel's history in a linear fashion. One famous reference is Isaiah 46:10. I'm sure when I read that, you'll understand it, remember it. I declare the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. You see, the prophetic outlook on history is that it has a beginning and it has an end. It does not go in cycles. History has a beginning, a middle, developing that beginning, and then an end where it's concluded. History is going somewhere. Klaus Westermann, an Old Testament and Hebrew scholar, says, Judaism was a highly teleological, that is, future-oriented. Judaism was a highly teleological faith. It rejected the cyclical views of time which dominated pagan thought, seeing history instead as a linear progression in which God's design gradually unfolded towards a predetermined end. And so when we study Bible prophecy, we're necessarily involved in linear history because we're dealing with what was in the past, developing in the present, and will be in the future, and will bring about the end. Noted historian of Western civilization is a man named Thomas Cahill. He wrote a book called The Gifts of the Jews. And in that book, we find this one statement. Of course, I don't want to read the whole book to you, but this one statement captures the essence of one of the gifts of the Jews to the world. Quote, a linear conception of history was one of the great gifts of the Jews to mankind. You see, paganism was caught up in a cyclical view of history, but Israel came on the scene and developed a linear view of history. Again, we are seeing Israel has a real historical interest. Her very faith is built up on a real world historical interest. And therefore, we should expect that her Bible opens with a real world interest in history and in creation. A creation history that involves a chronological progress forward as six-day creation teaches, as well as developing on beyond that after the creation is set in motion. Again, Israel's view of creation should match her historical interests. And we will see, and actually have been seeing, that it does so. Now, as we build the case for the historical character of creation, let's consider now Roman numeral 2 in my outline, Moses' historical introduction. The foundation of Israel's Bible is the first five books of the Bible, which is known as the Pentateuch, based on two Greek words that mean five books. The five books of Moses is what the word Pentateuch means. Moses is the founder of Israel as a historical nation, and he gives her laws to govern her historical movement in the world. And Genesis is one of the books of the Pentateuch that Moses wrote. And the book of Genesis opens with the creation account. Of course, all of that you know quite well. But in demonstrating the historical character of the creation account, we need to notice some things. And the first is this, capital A, the Pentateuch's unity. It's unity. Several observations will underscore the historical nature of the Pentateuch. First, the Pentateuch is understood conceptually as one book. It's five books. We call them the five books of Moses, but it is understood conceptually as one book. The Bible writers considered the Pentateuch to be one book. Frequently, we hear references to the book of Moses, Joshua 8, 31, 23, 6, 2 Kings 14, 6, etc., etc. And I think I have in your notes there some more references. We frequently hear reference to the book of Moses, but you never hear a reference to the books of Moses, because they understood that it was basically one book gathered together as one historical approach to the world and life. Secondly, the Pentateuch is linked grammatically as one book. Not only is it understood conceptually to be one book, but grammatically it's structured in such a way that it underscores the very notion that it is one book. Each book after Genesis, except for Deuteronomy, and there's a reason for that and I won't get into, but each book after Genesis begins with the word and. Now, usually our modern translations in English don't start it with and, because that's confusing to us if we tend to think of each book as separately. Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, Exodus, Numbers, we tend to think of them as different, distinct books. But when Moses wrote them, he started each one of these books, Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, you know the order. I don't know what it is. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Each one starts with and. And this is the Hebrew word wow, W-A-W. And it means and or then. And it denotes sequence. You see, the Pentateuch is not a random collection of books. The Pentateuch is one unfolding story, one massive story, five books long in our approach to it, five books long, but yet it is really one book. Thirdly, the Pentateuch is connected, linked grammatically. It's not only understood conceptually as one book, it's not only linked grammatically, but it's also connected logically as one historical book. So my third point is, the Pentateuch is connected logically as one historical book. Consider this. Genesis ends in Genesis 50, verse 26, with the death of Joseph. Well, the very next book is Exodus. Exodus 1, verses 5 through 8, begin with the death of Joseph. So you can see how they are connected logically. Exodus 40 ends with the erection of the tabernacle and the presence of God coming into the tabernacle in this great glory cloud where God fills the tabernacle. Well, Leviticus 1, verses 1 and 2 opens with God speaking from the tabernacle. It's already been prepared for by the end of Exodus. Leviticus 27, 34 ends by referring to the words from Sinai. Numbers 1, 1 opens by saying, the Lord spoke in the wilderness at Sinai. And so you see how they're linked together there. Numbers 36, 13 ends with, by the river Jordan. Deuteronomy 1:1 begins, across the river Jordan. And so you can see how logically the books are tied together. You can pick up each book individually and understand it on its own merits, but you don't get the big picture properly until you put it in its whole context of this one flowing story of Israel's history, Israel's early history. And so the Pentateuch is connected logically. Clearly, the Pentateuch is one continuous book with a connected historical story. Christians, the Pentateuch is historical through and through. Why would we not expect its creation opening to be historical as well? It would be totally out of character with the Jews' interest in history. It'd be out of character with the very structure and development of these opening books of the Bible. Well, let's now move to capital B, the Pentateuch's purpose. Now, this is going to be very important, although it's oftentimes overlooked in creation discussions. But why did Moses write the Pentateuch? To be the story of Israel's origins and her early history. Now, everybody knows that, but we're going to relate that to why the creation account appears at the beginning of this. We see this by considering what comes after the creation account. We're going to see Israel's story is going to be developed in the Pentateuch, beginning right after the creation account, because we have the three patriarchal founders of Israel, Abraham, Isaac, and Leroy. Wait a minute, it wasn't Leroy. Oh, yeah, Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, Israel. These three men begin the history of ethnic Israel. God's pre-covenantal call, before he establishes a covenant with Abraham, or his name is Abram at the time, God's pre-covenantal call to Abram appears in Genesis 12. And then the patriarchal history follows. Genesis 12 through 46, we have the patriarchal history developed. And then Jacob takes his family and moves to Egypt, which is developed in Genesis 47 through 50. And so we have the patriarchal founders brought on the scene, their history developed as they grow to be a large people and as they move into Egypt. Then Exodus opens with Israel's enormous expansion and her resulting enslavement because of the fear of Pharaoh that she's getting too big, that she will be able to overthrow his people. Then Exodus highlights the remarkable deliverance of Israel at the Exodus from Egypt. Then it presents a historical giving of the law and of the tabernacle. Then Leviticus picks up the historical story. And Leviticus formally establishes Israel's priesthood and tabernacle worship, which shall characterize her history as a worshiping people through all her history in the Old Testament. Then Numbers traces her historical wanderings as she is tested as she fails, as she is purged of her sin and moves on. And then finally, Deuteronomy is basically a book containing three sermons by Moses. The first sermon begins in Deuteronomy 1:1, the next one in Deuteronomy 5:1, and the last one in Deuteronomy 29:2. And in these sermons, he is reflecting. Moses is reflecting on and reminding Israel of her history as she prepares to finally enter the Promised Land. Therefore, in Deuteronomy, a recurring phrase is, at that time. When Moses is looking back, at that time. Deuteronomy 1:9, 1:16, 18, 2:34, and those other references you have there. And we see that there are frequent historical reminders. He frequently says, remember, you were a slave in Egypt. God is reminding her where she has come from so that she might rejoice in what he's going to be doing for her, giving her her own land. In chapter 5:15, 7:18, 9:7, and these other references. So, after Genesis 12, the whole remainder of the Pentateuch focuses on Israel's history, all the way through Deuteronomy 34 and the death of Moses as Israel's ready to enter into the Promised Land. Genesis 12 through 50, an Exodus 1 story from a family to a massive ethnic people. And Exodus 1 through 34 develop Israel's history as a nation. Christians, the Pentateuch has a historical purpose. Surely it starts in Genesis chapter 1. That Genesis 1 is intricately related to the whole historical narrative of the Pentateuch. How could such a unified historical document have a non-literal, non-historical foundation? The Pentateuch has 187 chapters. Genesis 12 through Deuteronomy 34 contains 176 chapters. And everyone fully recognizes these to be historical. They're dealing with Israel's history. Therefore, those 176 chapters show the historical emphasis and interest of the book of the Pentateuch. And Genesis 4 through 11, before Israel's story starts with the call of Abram, in Genesis 4 through 11, we have a development of the human race after Eden that leads to the arising of Abram, the father of Israel. There's eight more chapters we can add to the historical interest. Therefore, 184 chapters of the Pentateuch are clearly and irrefutably historical. And now we're left with only three chapters, Genesis 1, 2, and 3, which present to us creation and Eden. If this account is non-literal, if it is poetic, if it is mythological, then it's totally out of character with the remainder. These three chapters would clash with the 184 remaining chapters. They would have this whole large historical edifice sitting on a non-historical poetic expression. Therefore, the 184 chapters would be established on the non-historical poetry. Christians, the flow of the Pentateuch requires the historical reality of the creation account. But now finally, let's consider Roman numeral 3, Genesis historical focus. Now this study is laying the foundation for the creation account being historical. I bet you could tell that, couldn't you? The creation account does not stand alone. It is integral as a foundational part of the book of Genesis. So let us consider Genesis focus and how it affects the creation account. Now, I've done that in broad terms. Remember, I'm moving from broad to more narrow in my presentation here. Capital A, the question of genre. Genesis is a historical book dealing with historical issues. Moses is writing history. He's not writing poetry. Genesis only occasionally quotes poetry. And that's a poetic expression. Through 24, Lamech boasts that he's killed a man. You can look at it and see, well, that's a poetic expression. The English versions lay it out in stanza format. That's an intruding piece of poetry. Moses gives us poetic statements in Genesis 8, 22, 9, 6, and 7, and in several other places. But they're very clear and distinct from the surrounding historical narrative. You see these poetic expressions arising, expressed in poetic form, and then he returns back to considering the historical flow. So Moses could write poetry, but the creation account is not poetic. you will not see the creation account having distinctive poetic elements such as parallelism, where a statement is made one way and then the same statement is made in a different way. It will not have rhythmic style. It will not be involved with terse wording. These are characteristics of Hebrew poetry. This parallelism and this terse wording and this repetitive style are not characteristic of the creation narrative. So Genesis 1 is not poetic. It is prosaic, as modern translations show. Again, open your Bible, look at it, and see if it's structured like poetry. Compare it to the Psalms. If you have a modern version, you're going to see the Psalms put in stanza format. You never see Genesis put in a stanza format because Genesis 1 is not poetic. It emphasizes sequential narrative, historical narrative. Now, I want to consider Hebrew grammar for a moment, a real basic concept of Hebrew grammar. The Hebrew word for and, as I mentioned earlier, is while, W-A-W, spelled in English. And the while is very common in historical prose narrative. It provides sequential structure. A while is used in the historical narrative of the Pentateuch as a while consecutive. It's giving us one consecutive thing after another. And then, and then, and then. It's dealing with historical unfolding using the while consecutive, which is very common to historical narrative. Christians, in the first 34 verses of Genesis 1:1 through 2:3, by the way, the creation account doesn't really end until chapter 2, verse 3, despite the way our Bibles are broken down. In the first 34 verses of Genesis that deal with the creation account, there are 55 while consecutives. 34 verses, but 55 while consecutives emphasizing historical progress and chronology. The while consecutive is rare in poetry, but it is very common in prose. Genesis 1 and 2 opens and is directly linked to Genesis 3 through 11. And Genesis 3 through 11 is very historical. There are 64 geographic terms, 88 personal names, 48 generic names. Genesis 3 through 11 is dealing with history that can be called out as being geographically relevant, or personal names, or generic names. It's dealing with history. And Genesis 1 and 2 sets the stage for Genesis 3 through 11. The creation account is not out of place. It's not out of character in its historical setting. Genesis 1 and 2 introduces Genesis 3 through 11, which is historical. Therefore, Genesis 1 and 2 is also historical. And we must not be persuaded to think of it as poetic. Well, capital B, let's consider now the question of character. When you read Genesis 1, what do you see? Do you see anything in Genesis 1 that is bizarre? You do not. Everything is perfectly rational, reasonable, and comprehensible. It might be an experience we've never seen before, the creation of something, but the fact is these are reasonable, rational statements. Genesis 1 is absolutely and totally different from Egyptian mythology. Remember, Israel was in Egypt for those 400 years. And from Canaanite mythology, where the Jews are headed into the Promised Land. Genesis 1 has a view of creation totally different from Israel's past enslavement in Egypt. And it's totally different from the Canaanite conception of history. And they are moving into Canaan. So Moses is preparing them to recognize the error of the Egyptians and the error of the Canaanites in their view of things. Genesis 1 is totally different. There are no gods warring and tearing each other apart to form the sky and the earth, which is a Canaanite conception. That the way the world was created was a god was torn apart. Her upper half became the heavens, her lower half became the earth. There's no cosmic age from which the sun originally arose. There are no gods that are a compound of humans and animals, such as a god that has a man's body and a bull's head. None of that. You don't read any of that in the Genesis creation narrative because it's dealing with the real historical issues, not mythological issues. Christians, nothing in the creation account is bizarre or irrational. There's no chaos that creates order. Rather, Genesis presents a wise, powerful, peaceful God who creates an orderly, rational, predictable world. That's what we see when we read the creation account. Well, let's consider now, capital C, the question of structure. Genesis is a historical narrative with a distinct structuring device. Now, I'm talking about the whole book of Genesis, and then I'm going to back up into the creation account. Genesis is a historical narrative, as we've shown, and it has a distinct structuring device that emphasizes its historical character. And it's called the Toledoth formula. I think I have that written down there for you. Toledoth is a Hebrew word that is translated either generation or descendant or account. It occurs 10 times in Genesis as an intentional structuring device for the book of Genesis. It occurs in 2:4, 5:1, 6:9, 10:1, and these other references you have there in your notes. So listen carefully. This is important, and it offers great insight into the historical nature of the creation account. The Toledoth, these are the generations of, the Toledoth presents the offspring or results of the preceding narrative. Therefore, it introduces a new section to show the outcome of what has just preceded. For instance, Genesis 6:9, these are the generations of Noah. But when you read there, you find Noah's already on the scene. It's not the creation of Noah, it's the results of Noah, who has descended from him, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. These are the generations of Noah does not tell us how Noah came on the scene. It tells us how Shem, Ham, and Japheth came on the scene. These are the generations of Noah tell us the result of Noah being in the world. He had these three sons. 6:9, the Toledoth does not introduce Noah. It introduces his three sons who will establish a new race as the world has been wiped out by the flood. But now, we've got to relate this, narrow this, to consider the creation account. Let's go back to the first Toledoth, remembering that these 10 Toledoths provide an outline of Genesis. Genesis 2:4 is the first Toledoth. This is the account, this is the Toledoth of the heavens and the earth when they were created. This Toledoth does not introduce the creation of heaven and earth. That's already been recorded in Genesis chapter 1. But this Toledoth introduces the results of the creation of the heaven and earth. And by that I mean the creation of the heavens and the earth has already been recorded. Now this is the Toledoth. This is the offspring. This is the result of what God has created. And what is it? Adam, Eve, the Garden of Eden. These are things that God made for Adam. Oh, and then there's the temptation of Eve and Adam, their fall, their banishment from Eden. This shows what happened to God's very good creation. The first Toledoth, which tells us the results of what happened previously, tells us that the creation was created a very good place, Genesis 1:31, and it has a very good environment that God created especially for Adam, which is Eden, but that Adam fell and sinned and was banished. So again, we see that these 10 Toledoths are linking the historical development of the history of Israel. And the first one links the history of Adam and Eve and their fall to historical creation. Now, I'm going to relate that to Israel here in just a moment. Again, Genesis 1 is not poetic. It's not random. It is historical narrative introducing a historical reality. And the Bible genealogies demand Adam was a historical character. In Genesis 5, verses 3 and 4, we have Adam mentioned in his genealogy. 1 Chronicles 1:1, Luke 3:8, all mention Adam in terms of his genealogy. And so he was a real person who gave offspring into this world to develop the human race. But now let's finally consider, I'm drawing it more narrowly to the point of why the book of Israel's history opens with a creation narrative. So capital D, the question of mission. I noted earlier that the Pentateuch focuses on Israel. And of course, I think we all knew that, especially from Genesis 12 through Deuteronomy 34. There's those 176 chapters that focus on Israel. They mention the Philistines and others, of course, but the focus is very clearly on Israel and her history. It gives the early history of Israel, her origin in Abraham, her numerical expansion, her move to Egypt, her enslavement, her deliverance, her receiving of the law of God, her forming as a nation, her wandering in the wilderness all the way to the border of the Promised Land. But now, what is the role of the first 11 chapters of Genesis 1 through 11 that don't even mention the Jews, of course, because they arise after chapter 12 and following? What is the function of the first 11 chapters? Are they disconnected from the Pentateuchal story? Are the first 11 chapters unrelated to the remaining 176 chapters? No, they are part and parcel. In fact, they are foundational to the whole rest of the Pentateuch's narrative. Genesis 1 through 11 sets up the whole rest of the Pentateuch. Israel's historical intrusion into history in Genesis 12 and Deuteronomy 34. Genesis 1 through 11 sets it up, prepares the world, prepares history for the coming of Israel. So then, these chapters set Israel in her universal context. Israel is not just a stray nation, not just a random people wholly separated from the world. She is part and parcel of the world that God has created. In Nehemiah's praise of God, he links creation and Israel and the Promised Land, which I'm attempting to do here. Nehemiah 9:6-7 says, "You alone are the Lord. You have made the heavens, the heaven of heavens with all their hosts, the earth and all that is in it. You are the Lord God who chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldees and made a covenant with him to give him the land of the Canaanite." You see, Nehemiah is linking creation and Israel and the Promised Land. And we know that Israel and the Promised Land are historical realities. So the creation account is being brought into this historical reality. The creation account in Genesis was written by Moses for Israel. It's written in Hebrew. It's given to the Jewish people. It establishes the historical context for Israel's self-understanding. Israel is not to live for herself without reference to the world. Her God created all things, even the other nations, including the whole human race. All people descend from Adam, and Israel is one of those people, and she must recognize that. The genealogies in Genesis 5 and in Genesis 10 and 11 are designed to connect Abraham back to Adam. Genesis 5 has a genealogy that moves from Adam to Noah. Genesis 10 and 11 has a genealogy that moves from Noah to Abraham. Therefore, Genesis 1 through 11 is the foundational history of the rise, but there's more. She is one people among many, and she is connected to those people, but there's more. She has a role in this real world, and she has a function to reach out to the world. She has a divine mission. Genesis 3:15 offers hope of a redemptive seed that will save the world from sin. It's called the proto-evangelium, or the first promise of the gospel. It says, God speaking to Adam, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel." This is the story, and this is the story in poetic format of the conflict between Satan and the human race. Of course, I think you know that story. We won't get into it. But the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 10 and 11 trace that seed line. Genesis 5 traces from Adam through righteous Seth to Noah. Then Genesis 10 and 11 trace it from Noah to Abraham. The entire Old Testament is about Israel's role in God's redemptive mission to the world. Israel has a historical foundation in a historical creation with a historical mission. God called Abraham. Right at the very beginning, when he first speaks to Abraham, he calls him to a mission to the nations. Genesis 12, verses 2 and 3. I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. You have a role in history. You have a role among the nations. You have a historical function. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And later prophecies will call her to this world mission. Psalm 22, 27, Isaiah 2, verses 2 through 4, and these other references and many more. And the New Testament continues that. One of her offspring is Jesus Christ, who comes as the Redeemer in the fulfillment of the Proto-Evangelium from Genesis 3:15. He finally comes on the scene there in the New Testament. Christians, the Bible is not a mystical book given to myth and strange conceptions. It is fundamentally historical in character, and it is rational. The creation account opens these historical books regarding the origin of the world and man and Israel and Israel's redemptive mission in the world. Evangelicals should not write off Genesis 1 and 2 as a poetic flourish. The creation account is historical. It is true, and it's important. I want to close with a little story that shows you the problem of a non-historical understanding. It's like this husband. He and his wife are sitting out back drinking a glass of wine on a nice, pleasant fall day. And as they're talking, she suddenly says, if I died, would you marry me? Would you remarry? I'll ruin the joke before I get to it. He said, well, why would you bring up death when we're out here enjoying the beauty of this day and a nice glass of wine? He said, I don't want to talk about it. I don't even want to think about it. Well, the next day, they're sitting out there again, another beautiful day, drinking a glass of wine. She says, if I died, would you marry again? He says, why are you so morbid, always dwelling on this? I don't want to talk about it. I haven't even thought about it. I don't want to talk about it. Well, that went on for two or three more days. Then finally, in exasperation, on the fifth day, she asked him, if I died, would you marry again? He said, well, if you keep pressing it, I guess maybe I would. She said, would you allow her to live in our house? He said, well, yes, it's a good house. And it's paid for. I don't see any reason for getting rid of the house. Would you let her drive my car? He said, well, it's a good car, low mileage. I don't see any sense in getting rid of it. So yes, I guess she could drive your car. Would you let her use my golf clubs? He said, no, she's left-handed. He was deceptive. Well, there you go. Thank you for listening.